Everybody, tonight we're privileged to welcome to our parish Father George Wilson. Father George Wilson is originally from New York State. The state, not the city. When I first met him, I made the false assumption that you were an Anglo. That you were originally from England or something with a name like Wilson. And he quickly explained to me the story of his family and that his real name is Dedusis, I think. And some of the story about his family. So he's truly Greek Orthodox. You have the real credentials to prove it. And in some sense, your family story with your story and your wife is, I guess, emblematic of the Greek experience in America to some degree. Not that you're talking about it necessarily, but we're glad you're here. Father George has been a priest for 17 years in the Greek Archdiocese. He is a graduate of Holy Cross Seminary in Brookline, Massachusetts. And he's been the rector of Panagia Panta Vasilisa Church in Lexington for 13 years, I believe you told me. So we welcome you. We welcome Presbytera and Miss Mary. We're glad you're here. And Katina, good to have you with us tonight. And all our visitors, we're glad you're here. Father George, please welcome you.
Thank you. It's good to be together. Got all kinds of electronics going on here. I'm kind of in a whirlwind here. But thanks for inviting me. Of course, as the slide reminds you and me, I'm talking about the Greek Archdiocese today. I'm sorry I didn't have a chance to see Father's talk on the OCA, but I've done a little bit of research on that, so I think I know what he was talking about. So the Greek Archdiocese has a very long history in the U.S., and I'll get started with the program. Originally, the Greek Orthodox Archdiocese here in the United States was really created, if you will, to service the needs of the ethnic Greeks. And the earliest Greek settlers were brought here in 1767 to an area just near St. Augustine, Florida. It's called New Smyrna Beach. And they were brought here by a fellow. He was a doctor, and his name was Andrew Trumbull. And Dr. Turnbull went around to all those places, among them Smyrna, Crete, Mani, and also Sicily and some other places, to find people who I guess would be gullible. As it turns out, that's what he was looking for. He promised them land if they came to work it for him. But he was very much a taskmaster. He was he really had less than honorable intentions. And so very soon after they all came here, it was made clear to them that it was not a place that they wanted to be. There was basically an uprising among the indentured people, and they scattered. A number of the Greeks went north to St. Augustine, and they settled there after a while. Now, he fled as well, but they were of Greek heritage, but they weren't Orthodox Christians. The earliest Greek immigrants that we know of came because they were merchants, and as the slide says, in 1851, the Merchant Emporium House of Rawlis opened three branches, one in New York, one in New Orleans, and Savannah, to import goods and to export cotton. In 1864, the first organized Orthodox parish was the Holy Trinity Parish of New Orleans. Parishioners were merchants and their families, and any locals that perhaps would have been interested in such an exotic expression of faith. And most of the people were from Greece, Russia, and Serbia, and any other Orthodox who happened to wander through the area at the time. The actual first church was slightly bigger than our church in Lexington, and it was built in 1866. Today, the Holy Trinity Greek Orthodox Church in New Orleans is a cathedral. It's not huge, but it's substantial in size. And when the hurricane came through, it was under about, in some places, about 5 feet of water. And one of my schoolmates, Father Angelo Pappas, who's newly been assigned to the parish in Myrtle Beach, is that South Carolina?
Yeah.
He was in Portland, New Hampshire, Portsmouth, New Hampshire, for about 17 years, 18 years. He's a trained disaster specialist. He works with civil defense. He works with police and fire agencies, and he goes to these places to act as a chaplain and to help out as well. So he was there. There's a number of photographs that we saw online of him trying to salvage some of the holy items from the church, and there he was in his fire boots and all of the paraphernalia, carrying things out of the altar certainly knee-deep water, maybe a little higher in certain places. But this was the first real organized parish that went on to become a Greek Orthodox parish here in the country. The wave of immigration started very, very slowly from the early 1800s through the end of that century. It would be light immigration. But there was that noticeable increase of Greek immigrants starting in the late 1800s and 1890s up through the 1920s. And the Greeks, the Greek Orthodox, came from the Kingdom of Greece and also from the Ottoman Empire. And shortly after the events that took place in September of 1922, which is known as the Catastrophe of Smyrna, and we also know it as the Asia Minor Genocide and the Holocaust in Asia Minor, a number of the Orthodox Christians were displaced from their homes in the Anatolia region, northern Asia Minor, and found their way first to Greece, but a number of them spoke only Turkish, so they really didn't get along well with some of the people in Greece. Even though they were of Greek heritage, they were always, in one way, felt like outsiders, and so a number of them came to the country. Actually, a number of them came to Lexington because they had relatives here, not necessarily in those years, but they did find their way. As a matter of fact, the godparents of our parish was the Kafoglis family, and they have a relative that was the metropolitan bishop of Smyrna at the time of the uprising and the catastrophe, and he was captured by the mob and put to death. So they have relational ties to the situation. And our little parish, Panagia Panta Vasilisa, is named for a small chapel church in their hometown of Triglia, Asia Minor. And they were forced to evacuate their town. They went to Constantinople for a year or two, and then they made their way to the States and settled eventually in Lexington. Between 1900 and 1921, we had about 138 parishes, and it was organized by Greek immigrants, very much like the families you see there. This picture was taken in Salt Lake City, and it's 1908. And I don't know if you can see, but this is not uncommon. Of course, the priest is in the middle. You can tell who he is. You're right. I don't see any women there. But you do see something else here. Father?
I'm standing up to put this in my pocket.
Well, that's okay. I thought you were going to tell them what it is. What is that?
It's a dead body.
It is. And what they did often was, either in the church or on the steps in front of the church, they would have the coffin laid out. And everybody would gather around the coffin and they'd take pictures so that they could send the pictures back to their loved ones in Greece or wherever they might be, so they would know that their loved one was dead. Because no phones. And communication was pretty bad in those days. So they wanted to make sure that they knew that these important events took place. It reminds me of in New York, my first assignment as an assistant priest. It was the first wedding that I was going to do all by myself. In Jamaica, Queens, my priest domino, which is the pastor, the main priest, he would do all the services together so I could learn, because I was a new priest. So for all the baptisms, for all the weddings, for all the funerals, we did it together. He would show me how to do it, but he happened to be going to Florida on vacation, and there was this wedding that was scheduled, and since I was the only priest there, he had me do this wedding. And the only catch was it was to be entirely in Greek, because they were videotaping it so that the mother of the groom, who couldn't come from Crete, so she would know that her son was really married. So that was kind of like the situation with the funeral picture. When the church came to the United States, they really instituted a new organization of parishes, a very non-orthodox organization of parish. Lay leaders who were ignorant, I'm sorry, typo there, they were truly ignorant of church polity, really became the church leaders. And I say that, ignorance not being stupid, ignorance just being not knowing. We had a, well, most churches these days have a shortage of priests, but there was a very big shortage of priests in the early days. A lot of parishes actually were founded because a number of Greek immigrants came over, and they would get together for social functions. They would, you know, enjoy each other's company on weekends or whatever. But then, you know, there were marriages, and there were funerals, there were baptisms, and all those other events that were important for them as Orthodox Christians to make sure that they had the church there. So they would send for their, well, they would organize their parishes without the clergy. And when these events came up, they would get the clergy either from the old country or from other parishes that had already been developed. So they very much copied the church organization of some of the neighboring parishes, in particular from the Protestant world. Parishes developed without the input of hierarchs. In the examples that I just shared with you, from 1908 to 1918, the Greek Orthodox parishes in the United States were actually given over to the Church of Greece to be overseen. Okay, that's wrong. Greek Orthodox parishes in the U.S. given over the church. Okay. What happened was the Ecumenical Patriarchate had jurisdiction over the churches in the states. But the Patriarchate couldn't handle the administration of the churches. They handed over the administration of the churches to the Church of Greece. But this is correct. They never sent a bishop to the U.S., and some believe that it was the Synod of the Church of Greece was persuaded by the then Greek ambassador, Lambros Koromilas, not to assign a bishop to the U.S., so that he would retain the leadership role of all of the Greeks who are now in this country. He actually said that he understood religion to be a medieval hindrance. And so it was very, it's a pretty good guess that this is the reason why the church didn't send a representative here. The Ecumenical Patriarchate was preoccupied in those days, and we'll get to that right here. Ecumenical Patriarch Gregory V served in Constantinople from those years. There were times when the Turks would kick him out, and then, of course, they felt that it was okay for him to come back again, and that happened three times. He was very instrumental in the restoration of the patriarchal compound that we are presently in, even to today. Gregory was really pretty much a scapegoat to the Turks, because up until that time, the Ottoman Empire had included parts of most of Greece, and in the 1860s, I'm sorry, the 1820s, the early 1820s, there was an uprising by the people in Greece to stand up against the Turkish overlords and to push for their own independence. We celebrate that day on the 25th of March. The church chose that day because of the symbolism of the Annunciation, recognizing the fact that we ought to be free people so that we might pursue our free expression of our religion, of our life, with our relationship with Christ. So they chose to start the push for independence of the Greek Republic with the celebration of the Annunciation of the Theotokos. So Gregory was the one who they took it out on. And after Pascha that year, he was dragged from the church where he was celebrating liturgy, still wearing his vestments, and he was hanged at the gates of the Patriarchate. His body was there for 3 days, and until a mob of Jews came in, and I don't mean that in a derogatory way, it's just that's who it was that did it. I'm not a particular anti-Semite here, but it just happened to be historically people of Jewish background. And sorry about that. And then they took his body and they threw it into the water. There was a Greek boat out there, and the sailors recovered the body. And eventually they brought the body to Athens. And in the basement of the Cathedral Church in downtown Athens, there's this tomb that's with the marble and the blue. And that's where the body of Patriarch Gregory is entombed. Since he is recognized as a martyr, that they consider him to be an ethno-martyr, a national martyr for the Greek peoples. The gate where he was hanged at the Patriarchate has been sealed closed, and it's there, it's sealed, God bless you, and it's there for, this is Patriarch Bartholomew actually saying prayers in remembrance of the Patriarch. So that's the main entrance to the Patriarchate is actually over here, and it goes around where the original entrance was. So that's still very much in their minds today. You can't talk about the Greek Archdiocese in this country without reflecting on what was going on in that part of the world. So often when we look back in history and we say, well, you know, why did we do that? We should have done this. Why did they do that? But, you know, according to what the church says we ought to do, this is what they should have done. But unfortunately, our church roots are so very much intertwined with everyday life. And when it comes to changing of governments, especially from a monarchy to a republic and back and forth, it very much influenced and very much interrupted the daily goings-on for the people of Greece and really for the whole region as well. We'll be talking about this in a few seconds, but this was the King Constantine I, who served who was the monarch from 1868 to 1923, his life rather. He was born in 1868, died in 1923. He was the king from 1913 to 1917, and then again from 1920 to 1922. Ah, there's a gap there. Move over to the prime minister of Greece, who took power from the king, and he had power from my brother's birthday, October 6th, a few years before he was born, 1910, to the 25th of February. And in the meantime, over here, we've got the Metropolitan of Athens. This is Patriarch Meletios Metaxakis. He went on to become, he was originally the Metropolitan of Kition from 1910 to 1918. He was made the Metropolitan of Athens in all of Greece from 1918 to 1920. He became the Patriarch of Constantinople in 21 to 23, and then a few years later he became the Patriarch of of Alexandria from 26 to 1935 when he passed away.
Who was in charge from 1917 until 1920?
I'm not sure. These are the numbers that I came up with, and honestly, I didn't see that gap until now.
But they weren't buddies.
Well, at first I think they got along until something happened, and I'm not quite sure what happened. But let me continue with the story. I can find that out for you. As we saw from the list there, turmoil saw the prime minister come to power, deposing the king, and then the king returned in 1920. Again, there's a couple of years, I'm not sure who was in charge. As Archbishop of Greece, Meletios would not recognize the new government and was deposed as archbishop. Bishop Alexander was an early hierarch who was actually sent by the Patriarchate, by Archbishop Meletios of Athens to this country to oversee America. But since Alexander was held allegiance to Meletios, who was being deposed as the Archbishop of Athens, Greece decided to replace Alexander with a new bishop to oversee America. Okay. We've got the king and we've got the prime minister. There was obviously unrest in the home country, but that also came over to this country as well. The fight of the royalists and the Venizelists saw parishes split apart due to allegiance to either the monarch or the prime minister here in the United States. Matter of fact, Holy Trinity St. Nicholas in Cincinnati, did you ever wonder why they have two names? This is the reason why. Originally, it was one parish, and they split apart. And Holy Trinity, I believe, were the people that followed the prime minister, and usually it would be a St. Basil church that was named for the people in their parish that wanted to support the monarch, because Basil is related to the king. But in Cincinnati, the situation is that it's Holy Trinity and St. Nicholas. So they were apart because of this split, but a number of years later, they came back again together. So, okay. Are we following so far?
So at the time, there were two bishops as well?
Well, not officially, because the Church of Athens didn't recognize the one that was here. They basically suspended him. Because it was a new archbishop there. And actually, the original archbishop was in this country at the time. So, it's kind of confusing. January 1922. We're moving right along here. Meletios was then enthroned as patriarch, as I mentioned before. Okay, Meletios was really a character, and in some of the texts that I was rereading for today's talk, they said he was a very impatient man, and perhaps his impatience really went on to hurt him, but also hurt the church in a way as well. Almost immediately, when he became the patriarch, 2 months later, in March, the Synod of the Ecumenical Patriarchate announced the rescinding of the Tomos of 1908, which released the American Church to the Church of Greece. In 1908 is when the Patriarchate issued this proclamation, this Tomos, relinquishing its responsibility over the Church of America. So that gave the power to Greece. Well, when he became the Patriarch, he took the power back, which, according to the history of the Patriarchate, was the correct thing to do. But with all of the history and all of the events going on, neither place was a very stable place. May 22, the American Church was elevated to the status of archdiocese, and they had three districts, Boston, Chicago, and San Francisco. Bishop Alexander was named the first archbishop. The Greek national bishop then returned to Greece. So, at least they were following the order of the church. This picture was entitled The Greek Bishops, and I put it in there. So this is the Bishop of Boston. His name was Adopsopoulos. That sounds like a last name. It doesn't sound like a first name. This is the Archbishop of America, At the time, it was the Archdiocese of North and South America. And this is the Bishop of Chicago, Filaretos, and the Bishop of San Francisco. His name was Callistos. And so, effectively, at the time, since they're districts, not dioceses, it gets a little more complicated. So hold on to your seats. He was the archbishop, and they were assistant bishops for the districts. They hadn't been yet elevated to the level of diocese yet. The Greek archdiocese was incorporated in 1921. There's the original official seal. Any official document that we issue from our parishes needs to have the official seal. So this is the seal they would have used in the early days right after the incorporation. Our seal now is much different, and actually it was on the beginning slide. The calendar changes. I need another swig of coffee for this one. Maybe more than coffee. In May in 1923, an inter-Orthodox Congress was convened at Constantinople by Ecumenical Patriarch Meletios. Not all Orthodox churches were in attendance. Churches of Serbia, Romania, Greece, and Cyprus were. The churches of Alexandria, Antioch, and Jerusalem, although they were invited, they did not come. And the Church of Bulgaria was not even invited. And I'm not quite sure about that or why, but they did come back. So several issues were discussed at the Congress, one of which was the adoption of the new calendar. That's the Gregorian calendar, which was new in the 1500s. And the old calendar was the Julian calendar from the time that the church began. No unanimous agreement was reached on any of the issues discussed. Several of the Orthodox churches, however, did eventually agree, though not all at the same time, to adopt the new calendar. These were the churches of Constantinople, Alexandria, Antioch, Greece, Cyprus, Romania, Poland, and most recently, Bulgaria in 1968. And for Orthodox, that's recent. On the other hand, the churches of Jerusalem, Russia, and Serbia, along with monasteries and non-office, all continue to adhere to the old calendar. Officially, the Patriarchate of Constantinople and the Archdiocese of America made the change in 1924. My dad was born in 1924, and he was born on the 14th of January. And because for my yaya, my grandmother, who was still on the old calendar, it was right around the first of the year. And so, the 14th of January, she made his middle name Vasilios, or Basil, which is the feast of the 1st of January. So, there were some real issues there as well.
Now, that's sort of the modified new calendar, though, isn't it? I mean,
it's, as I told the Father, I'm presenting the history. I'm not getting into any of the issues. The Archbishops of the Archdiocese of America. Up until him, they were all considered to be the Archbishop of North and South America. We'll talk about the change in a few minutes. The first one was the one we talked about already, Bishop Archbishop Alexander. He was the Archbishop from 1922 to 1930. He was replaced by a very famous Archbishop, Athenagoras, who was the Bishop of Corinth in Greece. He was assigned as the Archbishop of America from 1931 to 1948. When he was elevated to the position of the Patriarch of Constantinople. And after him was Archbishop Michael, and he served from 1949 to 1958. It was really sad at the time. Our church is governed in legislative bodies called clergy lady congresses. You know, it's a non-profit organization, and there has to be some semblance of like with parish assemblies. On the national church, it's this congress, clergy-lady congress, and it meets every 2 years. And in 1958, it was being held in Salt Lake City. And, of course, the archbishop is at all of these events. And Archbishop Michael wasn't really feeling well, although not many people knew this at the time. And at the end of the congress, he was taken back to, I think he actually went to Washington. And he was admitted to the hospital where later he passed away. And he was a very learned man. He at one time was, if he wasn't the Archbishop of Great Britain, he certainly was a hierarch in Great Britain. So one of the reasons why he was assigned as our Archbishop in 49 was that he understood the English language and a bit of the English and American mindset. So he was our Archbishop until 58 when he passed. Archbishop Iacobus is the longest reigning hierarch Archbishop that we've had. He was enthroned on... He was actually enthroned... 3 days after I was born. He was enthroned on April 1st, 1959. And he was removed from office under the guise of being retired in 1996. He was getting up in age, but let's just say there was a little Byzantine intrigue that caused his... I shouldn't be saying these things. Can we edit that out?
Too late.
Yeah. So anyway, the end of his time of service was in 1996. With the retirement of Archbishop Iacobus, the Patriarchate decided at the time to take North and South America and split them up into a number of smaller metropolises and archdioceses. And so, effectively, as the primate of North and South America, he was in charge of, from the very top of Alaska to the very tip of, what is it, Argentina on the bottom? Or Chile? What's the furthest?
I think it's Argentina.
I think so. And the reality was, he only went to South America probably about 5 or 6 times in the 35 years he was our Archbishop. So the church in South America needed to have a hierarch there more regularly than that, if they hope to grow there. So what the Patriarchate then did was they divided North and South America up to be the metropolis of Canada, the Archdiocese of the United States, the metropolis of Central America and the Caribbean, and the metropolis of South America. So, of course, the hierarchs were assigned to the various places. The bishop that we had in Canada became the metropolitan in Canada, and he's been serving there since 1996 as the metropolitan of Canada. The Archbishop of America then became Archbishop Spiridon, and he was our archbishop for 3 long years. We'll talk about him in a second next. In Central America, the hierarch was a former American-born Greek, and he served parishes in Chicago, and he was actually in New York as an assistant bishop for a number of years, and he was our hierarch as an assistant to the archbishop in Schenectady, New York, where I got to know him, and his name is Metropolitan Athenagoras. And it's not the same one, obviously, but the same name. And he still serves as the Metropolitan of Central America. And the one that I was really getting to was a gentleman by the name of His Eminence, Metropolitan Tarasios. But my wife knew him as Tyche, which is a diminutive name for somebody named Paniotis. So Peter Anton... I guess it was Paniotis Antonopoulos, was born in Gary, Indiana, but as a young kid moved to San Antonio, where he attended school and church and church school and retreats and Goya events and all kinds of youth functions with my wife. And so they're essentially the same age, and now he's a big shot as the metropolitan of South America. I said it was 3 long years because I don't know if any of you followed this as much as we did in the Greek Archdiocese, but it was a very painful time for the Archdiocese. First of all, let me pause and say that whenever you have a dynasty in serving a parish or serving a metropolis or an archdiocese, 35 years is really considered a dynasty. We have priests who have been in their parishes for 30, 40, and 50 years in some cases. the reality. I mean, it's not just in Orthodox circles. It's in any church or any organization. If somebody's in charge for 20, 30, 40 years, and then their replacement comes along, that replacement really should only be an interim, because you're never going to be that person who was there for 35 years. You will always be the new guy. Oh, but so-and-so didn't do it like that. Well, you know, if I'm a priest in the parish for 35 years, I've baptized all the people who are 35 years and under. So these are the new church leaders, lay leaders in the church. So I'm the only priest they know. Well, if I'm out of the picture, the new guy, it's not fair to him, because they're not me, I'm not them. And whenever anybody's been in power or in a position for 35 years, the next person really will only have a 2 or 3 year tenure. And that's the reality of what happened with Archbishop Spyridon. Now that I've cleared my throat. So, in 1999, they went back to the concept of not getting an American-born archbishop. But this gentleman understood the American mindset, perhaps a lot better than somebody who was born here. Demetrios Trakatellas was a bishop of the Church of Greece. And back around 1967, he came over as an archimandrite, which is the highest rank of the celibate priesthood. It's just below, they're the candidates that they'd be considered to become bishops. So archimandrite Demetrios was in America, and he was studying at Harvard. He was a very, very brilliant, scholarly individual, but he was also a very, very spiritual individual. He was my professor of Old Testament studies. When he came to the States, his real specialty in church higher education is biblical studies, focusing, of course, on the New Testament. But since Holy Cross, our seminary at the time, had a tenured professor of New Testament studies, they chose him to be the Old Testament professor. And he's just a lovely, dynamic, incredible, very soft-spoken individual. But there are a number of times that I had the opportunity to talk to him. It wasn't confessional, but it was in his office, and we had an opportunity to interchange ideas. And there are some very pious individuals in the life of the church who basically can read your mind. They have a gift of clairvoyance. And usually it's done and used for good reasons. And this is one of those people. Because, you know, it's like we're on the same wave pattern or something. You know, it's almost as if he was looking into what I was thinking. So he's a very dynamic church leader. He's still our archbishop. He's 82 years old, and he's going strong. The other day somebody said, "Do you think that he might be retiring soon?" One of my brother priests. And the last time I saw him, he was just a spitfire. He's you know, just very active, and you know, he's, and thank God, he's healthy. So that's our hierarchy from the beginning of the archdiocese. Currently, we're composed of an archdiocesan district. Once they broke it down into just the Archdiocese of America, it was the archdiocesan district, which is the New York metro area, and 8 metropolises. The metropolises are New Jersey, Chicago, Atlanta, Detroit, San Francisco, Pittsburgh, Boston, and Denver. Don't ask me why New Jersey is a state and everything else is a city. Actually, it goes back to a time. It's a New Jersey state of mind? Yeah. I don't even know. It's Tenafly. Maybe it just didn't sound right. You know, the metropolis of Tenafly. That's where the cathedral is. We're governed by an archbishop and an eparchial synod of bishops. An eparchy is basically considered like a province. So essentially, we're a province of the Ecumenical Patriarchate, and since we're an eparchy, our synod of bishops is referred to as the eparchial synod. The synod of bishops is headed by the archbishop, comprised of the bishops who oversee the ministries of the metropolises, and since the... Oh, I forgot to say. You remember the districts? We had the four districts. Well, they were added... They were increased to about eight, and they were elevated in 1974 to be called dioceses. So then they each had a diocesan bishop, not an assistant bishop to the archbishop. But then, after the creation of the Archdiocese of the United States of America, then they were elevated to the level of metropolis. Effectively, it's still a diocese. It's just a fancier name for it. And so the bishops are still bishops, but they're called metropolitans. It's just I don't want to say an honorary title, but essentially it's an honorary title. The metropolis has all the authority. I'm sorry. The archdiocese has all the authority and responsibility which the church canons provide for a provincial synod of the Ecumenical Patriarchate. We have, this is an old number. Actually, some of the numbers are a little off because my original number said 450, 540. I'm getting dyslexic. The real number is around 620, but there's about 50 parishes that are too small to have full-time priests. We do have about 800 priests. Originally, this number said 1.5 million parishioners, faithful. But recently, through the organization SCOBA... Do you know about SCOBA?
I didn't talk about SCOBA, so please.
I wasn't planning on it. They're not one of my favorite groups. But anyway...
Turn the recorder off!
That's okay. They're about to be finished anyway. Standing Conference of Canonical Orthodox Bishops in America, SCOBA. Well, anyway, through SCOBA there was a survey taken, and the numbers that they came up with for faithful attending churches in the Greek Archdiocese is 550,000 people. Our original number said 1.5 million. Well, I can tell you for a fact that that's survey is not accurate because my numbers are not in it. Not that our 275 people, individual souls, would really impact that number, but if the reality of the survey is that there are a lot of parishes that didn't respond as I chose not to respond.
I think we're out of time.
Okay.
So we're not in there either.
So, this is the number that they say is reality. If it was 100% response, then I'd be okay with that. But I know, for a fact, two parishes weren't included. But that's what the number is that we're working with. And the archdiocese receives its ranks, within its ranks, and under its spiritual aegis and pastoral care, Orthodox Christians from either, this is right from our website, so I didn't have a chance to even read it, as individuals or an organized group of metropolises and parishes that voluntarily come to it and which acknowledge the ecclesiastical and canonical jurisdiction of the Ecumenical Patriarchate. Okay. People have chosen to become Orthodox, or they've, like me and my family, have grown up in the church. So the eparchial synod is pictured there in their chambers as they meet from time to time, I think monthly now. They're gathering for a function at a clergy laity congress. The listing of all of our hierarchs, a number of departments and ministries for our archdiocese, probably very much similar to the organizational chart of the OCA. Very important is number 98 down here on the bottom, youth and young adult ministries, stewardship, religious education. I'm hoping it's alphabetical. It is.
Yeah.
But anyway, we've got an office of outreach and evangelism, and Father Jim Corderis is in charge of that. He's just a very dynamic individual, and he's providing us with a lot of insight. He's providing us with a lot of materials that we're able to use. We've taken advantage of our parish development office I think the OCA has something like it called Stewardship and Associates or something like that. So we have that also. They came out and actually surveyed our people as we were in the early conceptual stages of our expansion and hopes for growth. So they were just a very valuable resource to call upon, and having them in our archdiocese made it easier because they understood us and we understood them. And as we actually have an advisory committee on science and technology. One of my classmates is Father Demetrios Demopoulos, and before he went to seminary, he was a professor, a doctor of genetics. His specialty was agriculture, but as he said, a gene is a gene, whether it's applied to the agricultural arenas or to the human embryonic discussions. You know, there are certain things that it's all the same kind of stuff. So he's become our expert on some of these scientific concerns and issues in the modern world. I forgot about our educational entities. Originally, our archdiocese had a small seminary, and of all names, St. Athanasius. It was actually located on a street that I haven't been able to find anymore. It's called Elm Street in Astoria, Queens, New York. I looked for it on a map, and it said it doesn't exist. So it's either part of LaGuardia Airport or something else that's been redeveloped into something else. And that lasted for a few years. The next seminary that was created for the training of priests and lay leaders in our church was called Holy Cross School of Theology, and it was 1937 in a small farm estate in Pomfret, Connecticut. In 1946, they realized they needed to be in a larger metropolitan area, and thank goodness they chose Boston over New York City. No offense, Father, but being an upstate New Yorker, the first time I ever went to New York City is when I had to go because the Archdiocese said I had to go there. And so that's...
You missed out.
Yeah, well, I lost my hair elsewhere.
Interesting factoid. 37 was the year that all three seminaries were established.
That's true. All three seminaries in the modern Orthodox world were started in that very same year. We moved to Brookline in 1946, and then in 1966 we expanded our educational endeavors there. We added the undergraduate programs of Hellenic College, and so now we have a full four-year liberal arts college. It has a religious studies major for those men who wish to go on for graduate school in the seminary. So we lovingly refer to those guys as the seven-year guys. And I was one of the four-year guys. I had gone to an undergraduate school elsewhere. And so since I went elsewhere for my BA, my Master of Divinity degree at the seminary was to be completed in 4 years as opposed to the seven-year guys who did 4 years undergraduate and 3 years in the graduate program. So we offer a Master of Divinity degree, a Master of Theological Study, and a Master of Theology, the MDiv, the MTS, and the THM. And our seminary is also a member of the BTI, the Boston Theological Institute, and there's about 9 seminaries in Boston, BC, BU, Andover, Newton, Harvard, Hellenic College of Holy Cross, Gordon-Conwell, I guess those are the major ones. They're huge names in the study of theology, but we kind of balance them out, being the only Orthodox school there. So didn't have the opportunity to take advantage of them. Oh, and then St. John's. And it's really kind of sad. St. John's is a Roman Catholic seminary. Beautiful campus, beautiful buildings, They had a great library when I was a student there. When my wife was a student there, they would always go to St. John's for the library. In the meantime, the bottom picture is our new library. And the library that existed when I was there was just, you can just see a shadow of the building in behind there. That was the library, and it was, and then maybe this whole rest of the building was added, and it's probably about 6 or 7 times the space dedicated to the library as it was when I was a student there. This has been named after Archbishop Iacobus, who I think he was still living when they dedicated the building, but died shortly after that. Getting back to St. John's, the need for priests in the Roman Catholic Church is so great that their number of seminarians is like a handful of people at this college campus that probably could handle about 350 students to 400 students. So it's, I pray that it doesn't happen to our church, but you never know with the society that we find ourselves in. Are there any questions before I talk about some of our specific ministries? Father?
I have a lot of respect for Archbishop Iacobus' ministries in America with other Christians during the Civil Rights Movement. Mm. I was wondering, can you say anything about that? That's a pretty interesting chapter, I think.
That's a funny story. okay. Let's see, that was in, was that Memphis or was that in, it was in Birmingham. Well, Selma is not far from Birmingham, right?
Yeah.
How far is it? Does anybody know? I think it was Birmingham. Well, it's a very famous cover of Life magazine. There's a picture of Archbishop Iacobus standing on this side looking very stern and very serious. And Martin Luther King standing right here also looking very serious. And I don't know who the other one was. Was it Ralph Abernathy? Well, it was one of his cronies, one of his peers, also very instrumental in his movement. And this picture appeared on the cover of Life magazine. That's good PR for the Greek Archdiocese and the Orthodox Church here in America. I'll leave the side story out.
No, tell us that story.
Well, the priest who was there knew that this was going on, and the Archbishop happened to be there in that town at the same time. And the priest really recommended that he do it. And the Archbishop at first had he probably didn't have any knowledge of it taking place. But basically the priest said, well, the car is going there, and we can leave you there, or we can bring you back with us after it's done, or something like that. But it ended up being a very positive thing for the movement, for Martin Luther King, and also for inter-Christian relations here in this country. Archbishop Iacobus was a very ecumenically minded individual. Every single president since Harry Truman has had somewhat regular audiences with our archbishops. And that's because of the work of Archbishop Iacobus, really. And Michael was there for a couple of times, but it was really Iacobus who, because long before, because during Truman, he wasn't here. He was still in Chambassy, Switzerland. But Athenagoras, actually, we've always had good relations with the government here in the States. When Athenagoras was named Patriarch of Constantinople, he actually was taken to Constantinople on the presidential plane, the U.S. presidential plane. That's a pretty good relationship. I don't suspect it would happen in these days. To get the Air Force One up in the air, it's probably a little more expensive than it was in those days. So they might send the Piper Cub after us now. But anyway, Iacobus did an incredible amount of work for the Archdiocese in the 35 years that he was the Archbishop. So a lot of people Well, most of the people that were ordained after me, because I was ordained in 93, and then 96 is when the Archbishop was retired. A lot of the younger priests don't know. They don't have a clue. Jacobus was a very stern individual. And whenever he was coming to seminary, we always knew about it, because the place had to be prepared. Everything was to be properly manicured and everything, everything in its place. And it was almost like everything was in lockdown, and everyone was anticipating, Jacobus is coming, Jacobus is coming. And it's far different than that now. And it's almost an expectation. Not to say that our current archbishop doesn't want things in the right place, but if something happens not to be in the right place, he's not going to really make a big deal about it. Whereas perhaps in the past, there was a big deal made about it. It may not have been the archbishop, but everybody around him was so nervous about making sure everything was right that it was, let's just say, not a very pleasant experience. Any other questions? Yes.
Father, the original seminary in Astoria, New York, is that still church property? What exists?
I have no idea. I couldn't find it on a map. It was on... the only way I found the address was I Googled it, and it came up in a book about cults and sects. they were talking about everybody. And it just happened to show on the very bottom of the page that the Greek Archdiocese had their archdiocesan center on 72nd Street in Manhattan. And they also had the seminary out in Astoria. And they also had a newspaper they called the Church Herald at the time. And that would have been about 1926, I believe. I think that's the date of the book. And it said it was at 173 Elm Street. And when I typed in Elm Street, it kept coming up. Don't you mean Elm Avenue? When it was a little further out, like in Floral Park, a little maybe 10 miles southeast of Astoria. So, I thought maybe it was taken over by a larger piece of property, maybe like one of the cemeteries or maybe LaGuardia, because that street doesn't seem to be there anymore. So it's not our property anymore. And if it is, they owe us some rent, I think.
Speaking of Greek property,
okay.
What about St. Nicholas? Is that the name of the
New York?
World Trade Center. Oh, thank you for bringing that up. We're back in negotiations, I guess, with the Port Authority. Obviously, you all know that St. Nicholas was a church that was probably no wider than our church location, although it was three or four stories tall. And it serviced about the same size community as our church does. But it was also open during the daytime for any people in the financial district to come down and meditate, say a prayer, light a candle, and just have some quiet time. So a number of the non-Orthodox people used to use that as a little sanctuary in the middle of their busy day. And when the South Tower fell on 9/11, it completely destroyed St. Nicholas Church. The only things that were found from the church were a small metal cross. It wasn't a blessing cross, but it was a cross from some of the decorations. A paper icon of St. Dionysius. And I believe the paper icon used to be in a frame, a glass frame. But the frame was nowhere to be seen, but the paper icon was almost intact. And there was one other article from the church that was recognizable. Everything else was either, flattened to be unrecognizable or disintegrated or vaporized. From the very beginning, the Port Authority, the Archdiocese, were in agreement that certainly St. Nicholas should be rebuilt. But the question always was, where should it be rebuilt? logic would say, rebuild it where it once stood. But when you're talking about that kind of an entity, New York, New Jersey Port Authority, I mean, that's logic is no longer in the equation. you have to think, though, what they're trying to do is rebuild those two structures into whatever final design they come up with. Well, there's a huge substructure that has to go under that whole facility. You're talking about, 20 floors down from the surface? Something like that. Because it has to accommodate parking. And the subway tracks have to go through there somehow. And then, all of the foundations for these huge buildings, they have to go down a substantial amount of distance from the surface. So there's a lot of stuff under the ground that we would have no ideas even there. They wanted to put what they called a... it had something to do with trucks and... if anybody knows more about it than me, please help. I think it was like a staging area for trucks. I think that's what they said it was. That was to be put underground, under where the old church was. That's what was planned for that place. And evidently, with having that kind of activity underground, there would always be some kind of a vibration of presence. So... I think originally they thought that wouldn't be appropriate for a church. So the Port Authority said about 100 yards down the street, there's a piece of property that they would be happy to let the church build on. And they even were talking about giving the church $20 million in addition to what they got from their insurance to help build this new facility. You know, some people are saying, well, the church wanted more than $20 million. And, they said... it's their fault. We said it's their fault. And I don't know whose fault it really is. I would believe the church is telling the truth. But, I don't know. I don't have a horse in that Port Authority game. So right now we're still talking to them. It all boils down to where the churches can be located.
We're not denying ownership.
No. I think that this situation is just so huge and so many people know about it that they wouldn't dare do anything like that. You know, some governments wouldn't have a problem with that. I mean, anybody work at UK here? Well, I trust you. But the UK can do anything they want, and they do. And they'll offer you a little bit of what you think it's really worth. But anyway, so that's it. Yes?
I heard that there was something like 36 different political or municipal entities involved in that whole
It's probably making up the Port Authority.
And it's not just the Port Authority.
But I mean, it's probably that group is made up of the City of New York,
It's such a complex political arena that it's really hard to bring all the players to the table.
But the real problem is the position of the church.
I'm going to let you finish and we can...
How do you know I'm not done? No, I'm not done.
You got to know what to look for.
This is Saints Cosmas and Damian. And they're the patron saints of our Philoptochos. And in Greek, philoptochos means friends of the poor. The Philoptica Society is the philanthropic arm of the Greek archdiocese parishes. So whenever the church is called upon to offer charity, it's always through the operation of the Philoptochos. They're a part of the church. They're not under the same... budget is the church. They have their own budget. They have their own board of trustees. But they are uniquely attached to the church. When Ecumenical Patriarch Athenagoras was our archbishop, he was the founder of this entity here in America. And the Philoptochos is 475 chapters. Not every parish has a Philoptochos chapter. They will do the charity under the umbrella of the church's organizations. but our parish does have a Philoptychos, and things seem to work better that way for the way we do, I don't want to say business, but how we operate our church. And this is their from their website talking about their this is their mission statement. So from the very beginning, aid the poor, the destitute, the hungry, the aged, the sick, the unemployed, the orphan, the imprisoned, the widowed, handicapped, victims of disasters, to undertake the burial of impoverished persons, and to offer assistance to anyone who may need the help of the church through fundraising efforts. When I was in New York, there was a woman who had a lot of emotional and personal problems, and she died a pauper. And so our Philoptychos had the property, the burial plots, and they let her be buried in one of them, and they probably had about 10 or 15 burial plots, and she was one of them. Same thing happened in Denver as well when I was there. And when I go back to Denver, I like to go and visit her grave because she's got nobody. And honestly, nobody who's there knows that she's there. And but the Philoptychos was instrumental in doing the right thing for these people. And
the orphanage in New York.
Used to. Does it say that?
No.
Oh, okay. The St. Basil Academy is actually in Garrison, New York. And in its inception, it was an orphanage. But over the years, it's not being used as an orphanage anymore. But rather, the kids that live there, it's like a boarding school. But it's not like, you know, a preppy kind of boarding school. It's a boarding school for kids who can't live in the family household anymore for whatever reason, whether it's drug abuse by the parents or gang situations or anything like that. If the children have been removed from the household, there's a place where they can live here. It's supervised and it's funded by the church. And is everybody okay? We're talking about kids here. So it's no longer an orphanage, but it's a boarding school, a boarding home, because the kids don't go to school there anymore either. It used to be a full, is it K through 12? Used to be? It used to be a K through 12 school, as well as being a boarding school. But the expense of all of that just became impossible for the church to continue to run it. So they had been having the kids go to the local public school, and everything was fine for a while. And there was actually an arrangement for the kids not to go to the local school, which was the cheapest way to do it. They were actually going to a different school district, and the school district gave them the same benefit as if they were living in the district. And then there was some sort of a blow-up. And then there was all kinds of threats of lawsuits. And anyway, politics. We'll move to the next slide. Youth ministry. In each parish, we're encouraged to focus on three groups specifically. Early childhood, for sure, but our real focus is on the Hope kindergarten through three, the Joy groups, ages 4 through 6, and the Goya. And in many parishes, they actually split it between junior Goya and senior Goya. And Hope is Hellenic Orthodox Priests, what is it?
Hellenic Orthodox Priests, the one education or something.
Something like that. Each of these real junior Orthodox youth, Greek Orthodox, Greek Orthodox Youth Association. Back in the 1960s, when early in the 50s, When Archbishop Michael was the Archbishop, he actually created Goya. But Goya is actually what Goyal, Young Adult Ministries, is now, because it was the people right out of high school, early, college ministries, and they were a very active group, especially in New York and Boston. But over the years, it's included the 7th through 12th age, 7th grade through 12th grade aged kids. And because 7th graders have different needs and concerns than 12th graders, most parishes, especially the bigger parishes, divided into the junior and the senior groups. So, you know, these are the umbrella groups. If we had any, we would focus on young adult ministry, OCF, Christian Fellowship, Ortho Campus Ministry, EOCS, Committee on Scouting. It's based in New York, but it includes... Do you have any scouts in your parish?
We do. We've actually had two of them working on it.
So you know all about those things, okay. Through prayer, the company that has the books and the pins and everything?
Yeah.
Or Pray, they call it.
Pray, yes.
With Camping Ministries, which is it's a huge summer youth program in every metropolis. We also have Ionian Village, which is a camp program in Greece for Goya-aged children. In the last couple of years, it's really been demanded that when you have youth workers, that they're properly trained in legal aspects, in a lot of other things. I think this movement really came out of the organized camping industry, camping camping industry, I guess, lack of better words. When you send kids away to overnight camps, you know, the staffs and the people there have to be trained and certified, and so that's an important concern in the day and age where we're living. And so the church has modified the same kinds of programs where they would train camping people, and they're applying it to camp workers in the church and other youth programs. I haven't told all of my youth workers and church school teachers, but within the next 2 years or so, every single one of them has to have... Katina, close your ears. Every single one of them has to have a police search record. And she works for the county attorney, so I'm not worried about that. You know, it's serious stuff. And so it's best to be cautious, taking precautions. So it's a huge focus of our youth ministry these days. And then they have a number of resources that are available to parishes. This is not getting them, but dealing with problems.
What's the difference between the OCM and the young adult ministries? Young adult...
OCF is college, yeah. Young adult. See, young adult is... But young adult is really being revamped, because it was people were very active in it 25 years ago. But in the last 5 to 8 years, people have been dropping out of the program and new people haven't been coming in. I think that it's kind of being replaced a little bit by OCF. And then, you know, the reality is, unfortunately, we're losing people. We're losing them, especially at the college age. And so that's why the OCF is now a very critical ministry. So that's the difference between those two organizations. Back when I talked about, Turnbull?
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Turnbull? Mm-hmm. When the people evacuated their place in New Smyrna Beach, a number of them came up to St. Augustine, and there was a particular place, this white building here. It's called the is it the Avino House?
Avino House. I used to know this. Sorry. I used to know this.
That's right.
I went there once a month.
Yeah, but the Avino House was actually, I think, a Roman Catholic person that owned it. But these people, since there were some people from Sicily, some people from all over the Balkan area, including the Greeks, they found this to be a safe haven when they were on the run from Turnbull in New Smyrna Beach. And so this became like a safe house for them. And The Greek Archdiocese purchased it a number of years ago, and what they've done here is they put a gift shop here and a museum in the back here, and in the very back is this little chapel. And this chapel has phenomenal acoustics.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
And when you walk in here, obviously you have your candles. And then the chapel is, you know, what is it, about 15 people can fit in there comfortably, maybe 35 packed in.
Yeah, 30 packed in there.
And so here's the sanctuary, here's the altar area, and I don't think there's even enough room for the priest to walk behind him. Maybe this much room.
Yeah, like, yeah.
And there's a little dome in there, and each of the little cross sides of the building are little domes as well. So if you're standing on the side over here under the dome and you're whispering to the person next to you, the person over here can hear you as if you're standing talking into their ear. It's a very similar thing that we had in Denver. Our church in Denver was a full dome. The whole church was a dome. In the 70s, they decided to take the basic Byzantine-style architecture and take it to its limits. So instead of having a dome on the church, they had the dome, which was the church. But I remember one time, there was a choir member up in the choir loft, and I was standing in the altar, and it was I had given the announcements or something, and so he turned to his buddy, and he said, "It's a wrap." And again, I heard him as clear as if he was standing next to me. So I reminded him of that later. But St. Focius Shrine is what the people at the museum refer to as our Plymouth Rock. But you have to think, a lot of these people were not Greek. They were Greeks, but not Orthodox necessarily. They may have been Orthodox, but it wasn't the reason they came here is to freely express their Orthodox faith. But it was a Greek presence, and that's the thing that the church really has focused on. They opened in 1982. And it's a beautiful place to go if you're ever down in the Jacksonville area. Plan a side trip to St. Augustine. It's a lovely little venue.
You can spend an hour there and enjoy it.
Yeah.
Nice gift shop, and museum.
Yeah, it's a nice little museum, right?
Is this the Rahman place?
Mm-hmm.
That was actually the first Orthodox facility my parents ever built.
And the neat thing is,
I still count on one hand the number of times I've been.
Well, the neat thing about that little chapel is the icons of the saints are basically full size. So you're standing in the church and you're standing next to, I don't know, St. Dionysius. And he's the same size as you are. So I think that's a really neat...
It's beautiful. Iconography is incredible.
Oh, it is lovely. It's lovely. I want to talk a little bit about Ahepa. And Ahepa really has historical roots in the life of the American Greek Orthodox Church. AHEPA stands for American Hellenic Educational Progressive Association, and that was its purpose when it was founded in 1922, and it was founded in Atlanta, Georgia. Its mission is to support Greek American charities, causes, and communities. It works closely with the Greek Orthodox Church. It is not a church organization, but it's a related. People who are Orthodox, Greek Orthodox Christians are sometimes in the AHEPA organizations. Its ladies auxiliary is called the Daughters of Penelope. That was founded in 1929. Supports two youth groups, the Sons of Pericles and the Maids of Athena. The AHEPA was founded as a fraternity in Atlanta in July 1922 following growing attacks on Greek Americans and Greek American businesses by the KKK. Its initial mission was to promote the image of Greeks in America, assist them with citizenship, and to fight against KKK attacks. With the full assimilation of Greek Americans, its mission evolved toward philanthropy, education, and promoting and preserving the Hellenic identity of the Greek Americans. And we are very thankful that our daughter received a small scholarship from AHEPA in Yaya's former home parish in San Antonio. And I also, on my way to seminary, received a small AHEPA scholarship from the Jacksonville community. So they really come through when you need them sometimes. But, you know, I mean, even in our little parish history, we used to have people that lived in Nicholasville. And and they were encouraged to move out because of the people in the white robes.
Did they run out of black people in Atlanta? Is that where they started?
I don't know.
Equal opportunity.
No, see, the KKK, they were opposed to the blacks. They were opposed to the Jews, Catholics, and any immigrants. So that's why the AHPA really made a push to Americanize the new immigrants so that they would assimilate and become American as quickly as possible. And, you know, along with that came a lot of the history of people like Vedusis, who became Wilson. You know, the last names were changed. And, you know, so often you see people... We had friends in Jacksonville. The family's name was Mastrogiannakis. Very Greek name. Well, one of the boys in the family changed it to Masters, and the other boy in the family changed it to Mastro. And what was the other? He kept the original name, right? And he kept the original. So that was a very real concern in those early days of becoming American as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. And the quickest way to start is to change your name. So instead of being Dimitrios Papastefanou, they would call him Jim Stevens. Or Jim, not even Pappas, because they were trying to get away from very, very Greeky sounding, very foreign sounding names. So that was not the HEPA encouraged them to do that, but people, I mean, yeah, you know, that was, but HEPA had a great deal of, offered a lot of help in the early years making them American. And then over the years, their focus shifted in retaining their Hellenic identities. So, not that they were keeping them Greek, but reminding them. And it's really a great organization, and they too do a lot of charity work as well. So, now I think I'm done. Are there any questions? Further questions?
I just had one. When the Orthodox came to America, and there weren't a lot of priests, obviously. So did parish councils form in America because there was no priest for a leadership role?
Parish councils, when churches formed into especially nonprofit organizations, they needed that structure of trustees and councils to operate.
Still needed.
For reporting. Right, but it was because of being seeking nonprofit status that was especially needed. In the old country, they still had parish presidents. Technically, the priest is the president of the parish. Because he's the assigned proistos, the first priest. And, you know, that would be the presiding priest is essentially the president. But in operating the business side of the church, and I don't like saying business side, spiritual side, because a lot of parish councils, not mine, but a lot of parish councils kind of focus on that. They say, well, Father, you go to church, and that's the spiritual side. You're in charge over there, but don't you... Don't you think? Don't tell us what to do up here. And I personally hadn't had, well, Jamaica, Queens, and stuff like that. But in the two other parishes that I served, never had an experience like that. There was a structure of lay leadership in the church, and there always has been. Mm-hmm. Because the clergy is important, but the lay members of the community make it complete. Now, I can't do a service without a layperson present. It's not like the Catholics where they have to do liturgy, they have to do Mass every single day. That's their part of the vocation. Whether there's people there or not. But I can't do that. You know, it's not complete without the lay people and the clergy. And so, you know, with that, I mean, there are certain roles that the clergy can do and ought to do, and there's certain roles that the lay people can and ought to do. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the purposes of parish councils. Whether they had them, I suspect that they did have them in the old days before priests came with you know.
They definitely had people organizing to get the families together.
Well, like, for example, in our parish here in Lexington, and being up in Lexington, there was a gentleman named Gus Johnson who was very instrumental in organizing people and making fundraising runs to every corner of Kentucky. Mike Levis, Angel's father, was also very instrumental early on. Mike Yonkus, even though he didn't do the minutes and or the treasury, he was the treasurer, but his wife did all the work. Mm-hmm. And so there was needs for those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And so whether they had a priest in the parish and an official parish, they still had some structure just to operate.
And like in my mom, there was no church. So the priest would come to baptize the kids, you know, on occasion. But there'd be someone who would organize that with a visiting priest to get them there. So that was always wherever in any community, you know, somebody involved.
Father George, are you aware of any at any point in the history of the Orthodox communities in Kentucky where there were Greeks that were not in Louisville or Lexington drawing on your services and the priests in Louisville services to do services and visit and baptize? Were there Greek communities elsewhere in Kentucky, or were they always concentrated mostly here? Orthodox are still thin on the ground here, it seems. This is like the thinnest state.
You know, it's interesting because Katina's from Hazard, Kentucky, originally, and well, her parents moved there when they were traveling early on. But in that general area, there were a lot of Russian miners that came over, and so there are a number of cemeteries down in that section of Kentucky that you'll come across gravestones with Russian names on them, and these were Russian Orthodox people, but they were. It was so hard, and this was probably even before the time that our parish was founded 62 years ago. And the likelihood of them going from way down in the coal mines of Hazard or in that general area all the way to Cincinnati, they might have done it for Pascha.
Yeah.
Or they, but Katina was baptized in Cincinnati.
That's right. But they were family. Chances are that the miners were single men. And then they probably married into the local family. Yeah.
Well, there was in my hometown, the town I grew up in, Maysville, the Cabelses, John Rado, and their sons, Peter and Stratos. It impressed everybody in town and knew about it. He would load the whole family into the car and take them to Cincinnati every single Sunday.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean,
how long is that? At least an hour on the road, right?
Yeah, closer to two.
2 hours. Well, we have parishioners that at one point when the Polychronopolises were here, he was a physician in Lebanon, Kentucky. So it was an hour and 15 minutes each way. So when I grew up, our parish was in Schenectady, New York, and I lived in Johnstown, New York. So it was about a 50 mile drive each way. And it wasn't easy, and we didn't go like the Campbellises every week. But as often as we could, you know, mom and dad loaded up the five kids, and we went off. And, you know, it's interesting, but when you go so far, chances are you're the first ones in church. And you look around and you think, where is everybody? It's 10 o'clock, you know, where is everybody? But you know, when you have to go so far, you plan better than when you just have to drive 3 minutes.
Father George, at the risk of, you know, you can go as deep or as shallow as you want to go with the question.
Shallow is always good.
What are you know, your thoughts, your church's thoughts about the Episcopal Assembly and all the stuff that's happening there? Or is something not happening?
Well, it's a good thing. Yeah, I referred to SCOBA a few minutes ago, and with this Episcopal Assembly, that's really ending the work of SCOBA. Because SCOBA was a forced entity to try to get the churches together. But the reality of the Episcopal Assembly is, in reality, to get the churches together on a greater scale. So it's a very positive thing for the church. It's perhaps better late than never, but it's something that should have been done some time ago. But you know, we weren't mature enough to be able to do it. And that's all I have to say about that.
Well, it's interesting to note that, you know, the largest group of Orthodox by far in America is the Greek Orthodox Church. Yeah. I think you outnumber us by 4 or 5 times, and the Antiochians by 6 or 7 times. And then we're all kind of following on close after that. Mm. So whatever happens in America will have to happen with the leadership of the Greeks.
I think it's been an interesting... I think we're still evolving, if you could say that, within the Greek Archdiocese. There was a period of time where, and you didn't talk about that, but when Athenagoras, he wanted the church to be all English, was that?
Iacobos.
Iacobos?
It was Iacobos.
It was Iacobos. Because we're here
in the early 1970s, it was said that the Archbishop actually said in an official meeting, probably at a clergy laity congress, he said that the official language should be English, and that they almost ran him out of town. But the reality is, the language was always English anyway. It's just in synod meetings, when the bishops all get together, their first languages are Greek, so they speak Greek. You know, one of the funny things that whenever I was assigned to a clergy association as an officer, I would move shortly after. In Jamaica, Queens, I was made the secretary of the organization, and within 2 months, I was in Denver. And then I became the treasurer in Denver, and within a year, I came here. But then I became the president of our clergy syndesmos, and I'm still here. So that's good. But in New York, the clergy meetings were all in Greek. And here I'm trying to take notes. Thank God I only had 2 meetings, and then I was out of there.
And you had a secretary who was from Greece.
Well, that was at the parish, but not for the clergy association. It was, it was because the bishop, the assistant bishop to the archbishop who was handling Queens, was a Greek immigrant. And that was his first language, so.
But I think that, but what's happened is there's still now a hole to try to not lose the ethnicity. And this is the struggle, and I think this will always be the struggle, because we all want our roots, and we all need to be connected to our roots. I don't want to lose the Greek. I don't speak the Greek well, but I don't want to lose it. My girls don't speak it, I'm sad to say. I think part of them would like to, but more importantly are some of those customs and traditions, and most of them are the church traditions, the proswo, the artikalesia, those kinds of things. But I do want them to know their roots. You know, I think that's it. I have an English grandmother. I don't know much about my English roots, but that's important, too. That makes us who we are. So I think there's that little bit of fear. But I think we're coming to realize that we don't have to lose anything. We gain. We can celebrate each other's cultures. And I think we're very blessed to be in a community that is small and can do that, where you can embrace, the different cultures of people and celebrate it. And yet we're all... Americans. But in many parishes, especially in New York, they still are very, very Greek. And it is hard. And it's very hard.
In New York in particular, because even in Chicago, a number of the suburban parishes are becoming much more English-speaking than they were when I was a kid.
The reality is people are marrying, they're not marrying Greeks from Greece. That's not the first language. And the farther you get, the harder it is. It's just the reality.
Is there much immigration right now, like another modern wave of Greek immigrants at all?
Not like it was. The places where you're seeing more, there are two areas where there are immigrants. And, in the sense of immigration, they're immigrants, but in our understanding of immigrants, they're really not. The University of Kentucky, for example, most of our Greek-born individuals are associated with master's or doctoral programs. So they're speaking English. Now, their background is all Greek, and in coffee hour, they love to talk Greek to me, even though I have no idea what they're saying most of the time. That's the reality of some. In the larger cities, you still have a lot of younger people coming over. But the reality in Greece, and Katina was just there, a month ago. In most places in Greece, people under 25 years of age all speak English with a good deal of functionality. It's
Russian? It's becoming that way in Russia too.
Yeah. Especially probably in the touristy areas, especially
Petersburg, Moscow.
Yeah.
It's still a tearing part. I mean, it's funny how it is, and I'm not even away, but you don't want to lose. And I don't think. Like, I love the fact that they want to speak Greek at the coffee shop. I think we should. If you have Russians here, you know, the
as long as somebody can understand what they're saying.
Yeah, well, even if you can't, you can learn, whatever. But the idea of all embracing, you know, so that people feel welcome, that's the
I know more than a couple of converts in the Greek church who part of what drew them was a sense of family among the Greeks.
Yeah.
And they were put off by it.
Well, I had one friend. Let me tell you, this was difficult for me because she had been a Catholic nun. This was in Jacksonville, Florida. Her name was Maria, but I don't remember her last name. She was a wonderful woman, but she hated that we did it in English. Here we were. We'd sit on one side. She thought it was so beautiful in Greek. And many people would say that, and I would say, well, what good is it if you don't understand it? You know, I mean, then you can't be called on because you don't really understand the words. And I do know it's really not a language issue, bottom line, because there's the language of the heart. It can be all in English and we don't hear it. We don't understand because our hearts aren't open. But it is an interesting thing. So there are those who are more Hellenophiles, they're coming in for that ethnic and the language. And I think that there's a danger there. So there's just that struggle. Maybe, and I think it's a positive, it can be. Mm-hmm.
That
we're kind of being
pulled.
Sorry to jump.
Any other questions for Father?
Or Mother?
I guess I'm always struck, hearing the history of the Greek Orthodox experience here and Father's talk, this is the history of America in a lot of ways, is the immigration, you know, and the cultural blending that's going on kind of across the board. Mm-hmm. It's really just intriguing.
It's a very normal and very typical entry into the States.